you're going to be out and about, folks, be careful out there. COVID is still floating around, whether we like it or not. We're going to still have to deal with it. That's sort of a lesson of Kyle Harper's excellent book, Plagues Upon the Earth, Disease and the Course of Human History. The march of history has, to a large extent, been determined by our attempts to stay one step ahead of various germs and diseases, to sort of conquer nature. And we've had successes and we've had some pretty significant failures. We're going to get into some of those problems right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Kyle Harper, before the break, we were talking about the profound and devastating impact of the conquest of the Americas by European invaders, settlers, etc., what it did to indigenous populations. I guess in some ways that's still unfolding. We see what's happening in the Brazilian rainforest is being burned and trees chopped down, and we push further and further out into areas where different kinds of germs, diseases await us, right?
That's right. I mean, that's one of the greatest risk factors for the emergence of new diseases is contact with wild animals that host new and unfamiliar pathogens that occasionally can adapt to the human host. We have to understand that the vast majority of the time they can't. They just don't have the DNA to have the tools to be able to infect humans. But, one out of every trillion times that a combination works allows diseases to emerge. And this is where new diseases come from the coronaviruses to Ebola to any of the other new infectious diseases that we've seen over the last generation. But this is a much deeper part of our past and has been going on as long as we've been around.
You also write about the impact of slavery in the New World from a disease standpoint, which I had not read before. I hadn't really even thought about it. But explain what you mean, how that figures into this picture.
Well, I think it's a huge part of the power dynamics that emerge following European crossing of the Atlantic in several ways. I mean, one is that the imposition of European imperialism along with the introduction of this huge array of diseases has such a devastating demographic effect in the New World. And that creates a whole lot of land and resources with very low populations. And so Europeans that are wanting to exploit the resources of the New World are desperate for labor. And they enslave as many Native Americans as they can. They bring indentured servants from Europe, and increasingly they bring chattel slaves from West Africa. And so the rise of the slave trade over the 16th and then increasingly in the 17th century is a huge part of the dynamic that's following in some ways the massive population losses. But it's also infectious diseases figure in another way, in that tropical Africa has a very dangerous disease environment, particularly for outsiders who have no acquired immunity. Diseases like malaria, that is probably the biggest obstacle to European colonization of Africa. And so in these centuries, European powers do colonize the New World, but they don't colonize places like West Africa. Instead, all they can do is set up trading forts where they incentivize the slave trade. And so diseases like malaria kill huge numbers of Europeans involved in the slave trade, even though there's really only limited numbers of Europeans from trading forts that ring the Atlantic coast of West Africa. So the disease environment of West Africa in some ways prevents the colonization of the region, whereas the New World doesn't have the same burden of disease and is colonized. So I think that's an important dynamic where diseases influence the sort of power dynamics of the early modern world. And then another is that as Europeans take enslaved Africans and ship them across the Atlantic to the New World, they also bring old world crops. So the importation of sugar and the the rise of a sugar plantation system is one of the really powerful forces that's motivating the rise of European power and the slave system in the New World. So along with new crops come new ecologies and new diseases. And one of the sort of invisible passengers on the slave trade is the diseases of the Old World. So kind of the arrival of smallpox is fairly well known, but a huge number of other diseases are carried over from Africa to the New World tropics, diseases like hookworm and yaws, as well as malaria and yellow fever, which are the really big ones. And particularly the most deadly form of malaria is brought from the Old World across the Atlantic to the New World. So this is a really massive transfer of every kind of pathogen from the Old World to the New, and it creates a radically new disease environment in the Americas. And so the disease environment of the Americas, just a century or century and a half after the voyage of Columbus, is really unrecognizable from what it had been.
Bringing things up to date, vaccination is now a bad word in a lot of ways, but vaccinations have worked on some terrible, terrible diseases throughout human history. I can't imagine what it would be like if I remember as a kid getting vaccinated for, among other things, polio. I can't imagine what it would be like for a president or administration to tell the nation right now, by the way, polio is a terrible disease. We're going to have to vaccinate everybody to protect your children. Can you imagine in this political environment how people would react?
Yeah, it's been one of the surprising features of the pandemic and living through it as a historian is how, unfortunately, politicized vaccines have become. I certainly look at it from a historian's perspective and somebody who studies the past of health and disease. And infectious diseases used to sort of have the upper hand on us. But as I said, most people most of the time died of infectious diseases. And the reason today that we enjoy predictability, long life, why infant mortality is a tragedy, why childhood death is a tragedy rather than an expectation, is because humans gain the upper hand. And we have several tools in our arsenal of biomedicine and public health, but the most important tool by far is vaccination. And vaccination goes back to the late 1790s when an English country doctor named Edward Jenner realized that basically milkmaids didn't get smallpox. He wasn't the first person to realize that, but he realized that exposure to cowpox, so people who were, for instance, milking dairy cows, would get little sores on their hand, a kind of mild infection known as cowpox. The germ that causes that, the virus, is very closely related to the virus that causes smallpox. And it's close enough that if you get cowpox, you got immunity, cross immunity, to smallpox. And at the time in England, smallpox was the number one killer. Something like 10% of the population died of smallpox. Most people would suffer it at some point in their lives. So it was a horrible disease. And vaccination was a kind of the first miracle cure, and it wasn't cure, it prevented it. It kept people from getting infected with smallpox. And it spread like wildfire. Edward Jenner ran basically controlled experiments to show that it was safe and effective. He didn't understand the mechanisms. He didn't know what a virus was, but he was able to run empirical controlled basically trials to show that if you infected someone intentionally with cowpox, that it kept them from getting infected with the most deadly disease. And so when the news spread, Thomas Jefferson found out about this. He wrote a letter to Edward Jenner and said, "You have made the greatest medical discovery in all of human history." And I think Thomas Jefferson was exactly right. Vaccination spread and allowed smallpox, which had been one of the deadliest diseases in our past, and certainly was the deadliest disease in Western Europe and the United States at the time, be driven to extinction. So smallpox is now extinct. There are no cases of smallpox today because of vaccination. And against an array of diseases, particularly viral diseases, vaccination is the most important tool we have. And so later in the 19th century, Louis Pasteur takes vaccination and makes it a kind of systematic science for exploring ways to prevent infection. And it spreads from there and becomes this way that we have to prevent otherwise unpreventable diseases from spreading. And so I would say our whole way of life, living in giant cities, living in a globally interconnected world, really depends on the vaccination schedule. So measles, mumps, rubella, polio, diseases that we don't now have to be vaccinated against, like smallpox, because it's been driven completely to extinction. These used to be just simply a feature of our society and introduced an element of uncertainty and suffering and sickness that we're not used to. And so COVID has been very destabilizing because we live in a world where we expect to control infectious disease, and it's sort of caught us by surprise and destabilized our society.
The world is just so much smaller than it used to be because of transportation. I mean, you talked earlier about the Roman roads. The success of those roads allowed diseases to travel to places they had never been able to travel to before. And now with intercontinental flights, a disease can spread from one continent to another in a matter of hours instead of weeks or months or years.
Exactly. Every time humans have invented a new transportation technology, going back to the horse and wheel, it has benefited our infectious diseases. And of course, it brings greater benefits. You know, the horse and wheel allowed civilization to thrive. But every time we invent a new transportation technology, whether it's the steamship and the railroad, which are the two big ones in the 19th century, humans figure out how to use fossil fuel to overcome the limits of animal-based transport. But when you build railroads, it connects populations and allows germs to spread. And this is absolutely apparent in the 19th century, that diseases like cholera and influenza spread further and faster than ever before because of transportation technologies. We live in the age of the jet airplane, and the rise of mass-scale civil aviation in the late 20th century has connected human societies around the globe like never before. And there's no going back. The advantages are massive. The world is small, as you put it. And that means that our health is interconnected, that diseases that emerge in China will be around the world within a matter of days or weeks. Look even at the Omicron variant discovered in South Africa, but by the time that variant was discovered, it was already everywhere because our global society is so interconnected that you can travel between any two points in the globe during the incubation phase of an infection. So we just have to grapple with the reality that my health in Oklahoma, your health, someone's health in New York are all interconnected both across the country, but even more importantly, around the globe.
So much of what you discuss in the book, it's our conquest of the natural world. We domesticate animals, and there are great benefits to that. But also that means that horses and pigs and their dung are outside our homes, and that leads to disease. We conquer the new world and investigate and explore new lands. But that means chopping down trees and clear-cutting forests and jungles and rainforests and things of that sort, which exposes us to all kinds of new diseases from animals that transfer to humans. I mean, I used the phrase microbial karma earlier, but it does seem like what comes around goes around, that the natural world can strike back, whether that's its intention or not.
Well, it's a basic principle of ecology. And we sometimes, I think, are arrogant and think that we're different or the rules don't apply to us. But if there's more humans and we're taking up more energy, then we're a bigger target. Bank robbers rob banks because that's where the money is. And microbes are going to try and invade cells wherever there's there's energy and nutrients to be stolen. And if there are 8 billion of us, there's going to be a lot of incentive for microbes to adapt the ability to exploit us. So it's a basic principle of nature. We just don't always think of our species or of human history in those terms.
With COVID, it still remains controversial about how it spread, how it originated and caused so many deaths and problems around the world, whether it escaped from a lab or whether it was a zoonotic disease that spread naturally from animals to us. I don't know if you have a position on that or have additional information, but this will happen again, right? It will happen again.
It will happen again. And I mean, I don't have a particularly strong opinion. I do think it's important to be open-minded about the origins of COVID and to let science do what science does best, which is to ask questions with an open mind and decide based on the evidence. And obviously, even the intelligence community in this country has been divided. So it's not a clear answer one way or another. But if my own opinion as a historian of disease, which is like anybody else, we're kind of the way we view the world is framed by what we know. And I studied the hundreds of infectious diseases that afflict humans, and they've all emerged from wild animal hosts. And so it certainly seems to me like there's a strong probability that the origins of COVID are completely natural, that it's a coronavirus like many other coronaviruses that has proven able to jump from a wild animal to humans and to cause a very contagious kind of respiratory disease. So I think that that seems to be a stronger case to me as a historian who spends most of my time thinking about the hundreds of diseases that are adapted to humans. So as you say, though, whatever its origins, this won't be the last. And in fact, if you look at the last generation, we were warned not to be complacent about the ongoing danger of the evolution of microbes and emerging infectious diseases. And human nature is what it is. We're bad at judging risk. And, if something's not right in front of us, we struggle to prepare for it. And even though there were a number of close calls over the last generation, including Ebola virus and very much including the first SARS in 2002-2003, there was another coronavirus closely related to SARS-CoV-2 that did jump to humans and cause a global outbreak that was fortunately very limited. There were strong early interventions, and it was slightly easier to stop because it didn't spread quite as easily among asymptomatic patients. So
I'll tell you what, Kyle, we're going to have to take another break. We're talking with Kyle Harper about his great book, Plagues Upon the Earth, and we'll open up the phone line soon with your calls, questions, comments. We've been talking about pandemics, diseases, germs, microbes, and how they spread around the world. COVID-19 has been deadly for sure. It's killed millions of people around the world, hundreds of thousands of them here in the United States. But it could have been much worse. I mean, there are far deadlier diseases out there, but they were not as transmissible. That is not to say that the next pandemic will be any easier for us to handle. What have we learned during COVID-19? What didn't we learn? We're going to ask that of my guest, Kyle Harper, author of Plagues Upon the Earth, and take some of your calls with questions and comments right after this in our final segment of tonight's Coast to Coast AM. Kyle, you write in your book about far more dangerous diseases, deadlier diseases, causing more fatalities are floating around out there, like Ebola, but they are not as effective as transmitting as, say, COVID-19. That's not to say that something deadly could come along that is just as transmissible or more so. I mean, could you forecast a little bit about what comes next in terms of the next pandemic?
Exactly. I mean, COVID-19 doesn't come out of the blue. It comes out of a very deep history of human expansion and did you call it microbial karma? I like them to use that.
Good.
And even in the last generation, we've had a continuous series of near misses. We just have been playing with fire. There's 8 billion of us. We're all connected by jets. We live in cities. There are cities today like Tokyo that are twice the size of the total human population at the time farming was invented globally. So it's inevitable that this is going to happen. We were warned and we were still complacent and completely unprepared. So we have to ask, what can we learn from this experience to be ready for the next one? Because there will be a next one and we don't know what it'll be like. Just as you say, COVID-19 is extremely contagious, and it's kind of uncanny how good it is at exploiting the kind of society we have. It's good at asymptomatic transmission. It causes quite a severe disease, but it's very age skewed. So if you're young, it's a relatively low risk. And that obviously has greatly affected the politics of our social response, that many age cohorts really don't have to live in great fear of extremely severe disease. So the next one could be very different. And the great danger, the big one, is that there's a potential disease that's as contagious as COVID-19, but it causes an even more severe disease in a broader cross-section of the population. So we have to realize this was not, this didn't come out of nowhere, and it's going to happen again. So I think one thing we've obviously learned from this experience is we weren't ready, despite the fact that we were warned. We just have to be honest that that the way we've responded in this country, globally, has not been very effective. And it has to, the preparedness for the future has to include new scientific solutions, so the ability to build vaccines quickly, as well as therapeutics, particularly antiviral medicines that I think are going to be taking a great leap forward because of the amount of biomedical research that's focused on this pandemic. But also other kinds of scientific tools like surveillance, monitoring for where disease hotspots are, identifying where the risks are, creating surveillance systems that allow us to track new diseases as quickly as they emerge so that we can hopefully keep the next one from getting out into a broad population. So that's the great hope, is that a disease like COVID-19 can be stopped before it gets so widespread so fast. That's what happened with the first SARS in 2002, 2003. And as I said, it's a little easier to stop, but it could have been the cause of a really disruptive global pandemic and wasn't. So you have to hope that by understanding where diseases are likely to jump to humans, and then by finding ways to monitor for the emergence of new diseases, and then there has to be a better political response. Pandemics are always very politically challenging because they're costly, and they cost different people different things. So if you're a small business owner, you're going to think of public health interventions very differently than if you're not. If you're, in this case, if you're older or you have underlying health issues that mean if you get COVID, you're going to be at higher risk for severe disease, you're going to think of the disease very differently than if you're a young, healthy 20-year-old who wants to go live normal life. So the politics of disease are very complicated because the costs and benefits and risks are spread very unevenly. And clearly, the response to this pandemic has been very frustrating. And a lot of the frustration has to be that now that we have vaccines that are relatively good at helping to control the pandemic, we still haven't brought it under control. Hopefully, the most optimistic scenario is that Omicron causes a less severe disease, and that it continues to spread immunity along with vaccination. And so increasing population immunity helps bring this pandemic under control. But we can't take for granted that that's the course it will take. I mean, even a few 2 months ago, I was involved in a panel with a variety of different experts from different perspectives, and there were very smart people who thought that we were already kind of turning the corner. And then Omicron emerged and clearly is going to put us through another round of instability and frustration. And so we don't know if that's the last big trick that that this virus has up its sleeve or not. Hopefully it is. But even if we do finally kind of emerge back to a level of stability and normalcy with this virus, there will be another one.
Let's take some calls. The phone lines are full, by the way. First-time caller, Paul in San Diego. Good morning, Paul. You're on with Kyle Harper.
Oh, good morning. George Knapp, my favorite coast-to-coast host. I appreciate it. I have a question for Dr. Harper. It's regarding the scabies, the little microscopic eight-legged, with no eyes, bug that seems to be a problem. Well, I don't know. It's a friend of mine. Their dog went in the park here in San Diego, and he would chase rabbits, and he contracted these little microscopic scabies from these rabbits, and so he's been plagued now, this friend, for over 10 years with what they just generally call scabies, and it's the only thing they know is to treat it with ivermectin, which doesn't seem very effective. The scabies, there's a female and a male. The female's a little larger. They're both microscopic. You can't see them.
Let's ask Kyle Harper about that. I don't remember seeing scabies in the book, but have you dug into that, Kyle?
You can write a long book about infectious disease and never get to all of them. And scabies is a little different from most of the infectious diseases that I'm talking about, because I'm largely focused on diseases that are caused by viruses, bacteria, and protozoa. There are infectious diseases that are caused by arthropods, by insects or mites, and scabies is actually a disease caused by mites, so tiny, tiny little bugs that burrow into your skin, and it is transmissible. It certainly flourishes in certain kinds of conditions. It's still a problem today. It can be very difficult to treat, and certainly it is a disease that in the past would have been even more prevalent. So it can affect anybody, but it can really thrive in conditions of squalor. So we have large populations living in, say, like a pre-industrial city where most people are very poor, where there's not modern hygiene. This must have been a pretty prevalent disease. So it's not one I talk about, but that's not to say it wasn't pretty important throughout the human past and still kind of a challenging disease to treat.
Paul, thank you for the call. On the wildcard line, Michael in Virginia Beach, Virginia, you're on the air.
Thank you so much, George. Kyle, every time I turn on the radio or television, I hear Dr. Anthony Fauci being introduced as America's top infectious disease expert. I'm wondering if in your long years of academic study in the history of pandemics, if you have ever met Dr. Fauci.
No, it's a good question. I have not. So I'm a historian of disease, which means I don't necessarily always interact with practicing government officials or clinicians. Although in my own work, I try and learn from and work with all kinds of different scientists. So even though I'm a historian, I do spend time with microbiologists and write papers with other kinds of natural scientists. And I really think that's one of the best ways to study the world is not just through one kind of field or expertise. So I do work quite a bit with natural scientists, but I haven't met Dr. Fauci. I do know his work, both as his long-term office as the director of the NIAID, but also he's a scholar and even written a few papers on the history of disease and history of medicine. So he's someone whose work I was familiar with long before he became a household name in the COVID-19 pandemic.
Thanks for that call. Brendan in Austin, Texas. Hi, Brendan. You're on with Kyle Harper.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much, George, Dr. Harper, all the listeners. Happy holidays. So what I was thinking was that, I just got diagnosed with COVID or tested positive COVID recently, and I got over it pretty quickly. I'm still getting over it, but it sucked. It was not the cold. So definitely, I just had to say that. But I don't think we would be in this position if we had a president that hadn't called it the Kung Flu. And my original question is that all these rich CEOs are flying away to their bunkers and mansions, and they expect us to keep on working and be on the line and sacrifice ourselves. And it seems like they ran the numbers, and investing in us being safe wasn't good in their profit margins. So do you think that in the future there's going to be room for accountability for these sorts of things? And how do you think people's react, the public's reaction to another pandemic would be to the CEOs?
Well, and thanks for your question, and I think I understand what you're asking, which is, you know, how getting at the question of how infectious diseases affect different social groups very differently, and it's not strictly on kind of rich versus middle class versus poor. Think of the frontline health workers, including medical doctors, who are really have no choice but to be very, very exposed to infectious disease, particularly in this pandemic. What you're asking is why are some essential workers exposed and unable to take kind of distancing measures, whereas other people can afford to work from home or to quit working for a while. And it's been one of the real features of this pandemic is that people have different risk exposure based on their age and their health. And they have different kinds of social risk based on where they live, their job, and the kind of choices they're able to make. And so very clearly, some employees who have the work from home option have been very advantaged and able to take measures to distance themselves from infection, whereas others haven't. And so it goes back to what I was saying about the reason why the politics of a pandemic really are so tricky and require good leadership, good communication, as well as a kind of understanding of the differential risks and costs of living through a pandemic. And it's one of the areas where we have to learn from this experience to be ready for the next one, which could be even worse. So thank you.
I think about the grocery clerks who became frontline workers, postal service employees, Amazon delivery folks, food service delivery. All those folks became frontline workers this time around.
That's right. And you know, even things where you wouldn't have maybe thought beforehand, but a lot in the meat production industry was really heavily hit. And it's because of the working conditions and the essential role that those employees play in our society.
Try to get one more call in. Mike in Denver, Colorado. Mike, you got to make this one quick. You get the last question with Kyle Harper.
Well, thank you so much for taking my call, George and Professor Harper. It is such an honor to speak with you. Thank you so much for your presentation. And I just had a very quick comment and question. So the bubonic plague, which you were talking about earlier, I know it had such a huge impact on Italian society in terms of death. But, you know, it was said that after the plague kind of decreased, there was this new created demand for goods and services. And, you know, this new middle class kind of started to emerge from this plague, from the kind of the increased demand for services. And I know bubonic plague was kind of said to actually be one of the main causes for the Italian Renaissance. So my question is, do you see a possible similar renaissance kind of emerging from COVID-19, similar to the Italian Renaissance with the bubonic plague?
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, are there any positive developments that come out of this?
Great. Well, thanks for a great question. And historians love to think about these things. And of course, we love long answers. So I have to tell you, read some of the things I have to say in the book. But the economic consequences of the bubonic plague were complicated. They were very bad in some places. But in other places, if you were a survivor, if you were one of the 50% of the people that was left standing, it was a world where you had more stuff. There was more land and more capital per person And that did help create a new middle class, consumer class. But that wasn't universal. It sort of took a range of lucky conditions for that to emerge. And yes, you're right that in some ways the trauma of the Black Death does contribute in various ways to the cultural movements that emerge in Italy in the late 14th century. Our world is very different, I just have to say, because we're running out of time. I'm not so optimistic that COVID-19 is going to inspire anything like the Renaissance, but it's an optimistic take on it, and certainly I'm a historian, not a futurist, so we can hopefully hope for the best.
All right, Kyle Harper, I really enjoyed the book as a history lesson and also as the history of diseases. I hope people will check it out, Plagues Upon the Earth, and I really enjoyed our conversation. Thanks for being here.
So did I. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks. Thanks also to Bruce Solheim, our earlier guest, and my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Adam Thompson, and Jeremiah Harris, Michael Cosio, Lex Lonehood, Ryan Stacey, Dan Kalani, and Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. Happy New Year, everyone. Be careful out there.